We will continue kind of working through Matthew. There's not a specific Mother's Day sermon, nor will we have a specific Father's Day sermon. But as we sort of get through the end of May into the summer, we're going to kind of wrap up a little bit of time and take a little bit of a break from Matthew as the summer goes. But we've got a few more weeks of kind of finishing up here. And we have a really good parable, a really rich parable, right before Jesus gets into Jerusalem. So we're going to take a break at a pretty good spot in the storytelling. And so we'll be in Matthew 20 today, verses 1 through 16. Oh, and if you're new with us, my name's Chris. I'm a pastor and elder here at Resonate. But have you ever experienced a situation where you felt maybe unfairly treated or overlooked? And how did you respond in that moment? Maybe something similar. Maybe someone else got paid for being lazy, and not that these people are lazy, but maybe that was your experience. Or you worked on a school project, and it was a group project, and you put in all the work, but everybody else got the A, or things like that. Those sort of experiences where it's like, oh man, like this just feels unfair. Or maybe a time when you've witnessed someone receive maybe unexpected kindness or generosity. You've watched someone else kind of give generosity to people who may be undeserving in that moment. How did that make you feel in those kind of moments? Or even consider the concept of fairness, right? And if you're a parent, you understand this because your kids are like, that's not fair about everything. But the concept of fairness, do you believe that life is always fair? Or do we acknowledge that there's some sense of maybe unfairness, inequality that truly does kind of exist all around us? That's a part of reality. Because we have to remember that the disciples are walking in with the previous story and wrestling with this upside downness that God, Jesus has been teaching, this great Jewish man who was following the Torah, is wealthy, is doing all these sort of things, ends up not being the central example in the storyline versus some other characters that Jesus has kind of put front and center, like the Roman centurion, who Jesus says, never in all of Israel have I seen such faith. It's backwards. And he capstones the last teaching and this teaching with the phrase, the last first, the first last. He's pointing out just the unique nature that the crowds are strongly misunderstanding what Jesus' kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, is really all about. So let's dive into this text, and then we'll talk through some application on the back end. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for the vineyard, and after agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into the vineyard. Now, this is unique, that the master of the house would be the one to go out and do this. Often they would have their own servants that would also recruit more servants. So there's something unique to that, but we'll get there at the end. But the master goes out, and with this first crowd, as already pointed out, agrees to a specific amount, a specific sort of wage or reward at the end of a work day to that crowd. So they're the only ones that get that sort of specific agreement. In the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, said to them, you go to the vineyard too, whatever's right. And he does the same at the sixth and the ninth hour. And at the 11th hour, he found others standing, and he said to them, this is sort of a unique dialogue, why do you stand here idle all day? Like, why haven't you done anything? And they said, because no one has hired us. No one's actually invited us in. He said to them, you go to the vineyard too. So there's various addition of workers through the years, or through this time, and there's really no language of agreement amongst any of them. It's just what is fair. And so they get brought in, these various collections of people. Now, it's pretty straightforward storytelling. It's not confusing up to this point. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to the foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. Now, what's peculiar about the choice of the master here? If you were the master in this moment, what order would you pay the people in to not cause any controversies? For real. You would pay the people that were there first, right? And you'd give them their denarius, and they would likely just go walk away. And then you could pay everybody else in the order as they came that day and cause really no controversies at all. But that's not, he explicitly goes out of his way to go, here's what I want you to do. You know those people that just have only worked an hour? Pay them first. I want everybody else to see this. There's something peculiar about how the master does this. It's the question of, like, well, for what purpose? What is the meaning of that? Why do it that way? And when those hired about the 11th hour, each of them received a denarius. So they got the amount that the group at the beginning of the day agreed to. Now, when those hired first came, so there's really two crowds that become the object of the story, the last and the first. And when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each one of them received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled to the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only an hour, and you have made them equal to us and have borne who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." So perhaps very reasonably, this crowd's like, hey, those people only worked an hour. You give them a denarius. We were kind of expecting more at this point in the story. They don't receive that. They do receive exactly what they agreed upon. So the master of the house is not slighting this crowd at all. He's giving them exactly what they should have expected and what they agreed upon. There's no real sense of them saying, but that's not fair. But that's essentially what they're saying. And if you're sitting here going, yeah, that really isn't fair, good. I think you're right where Jesus wants you to be. I think that's the emotion that we are supposed to have as hearing the story. We're supposed to be like, man, that really isn't fair. Like, if I was the morning worker, I'd be upset too. Now, I want to unpack some context for us to actually interpret this text really well. Because he could have simply said, the crowd comes, that these first workers come, and said, these last worked only an hour, and they have made us equal to us who have worked all day. Would have been a perfectly applicable phrase, would have been not a problem. The unique thing is that they say those of us who have borne the burden of the day in the scorching heat, or really the borne the heat of the day. And this phrase is found in multiple sort of ancient rabbinic texts. And it's often used to refer to the Jewish people. So you have something like the Avodah Zarah. It talks about how the Jewish people were able to endure the heat of the day when the Gentiles would never be able to do that. It was a phrase that was often connected to the Jewish people. And it was metaphoric for them to talk about those who carry the weight of the Torah for the world. So that the world would know who God is. They would eat kosher. They would wear fabric where certain cottons and stuff are not intermingled. They would observe cleanliness laws. They would do the things that Torah had demanded of them so that the nations would know. That's what Exodus says. You are going to be my unique nation, set apart, and do all these kind of weird things that the Gentiles don't do so that the Gentiles know what I am like. They carried that weight. They carried sort of the burden so that others would have a clear understanding of who God is. That was sort of the metaphor. That was the picture at hand. They were the ones with a very clear agreement at the start, too, right? They come to Mount Sinai. God's like, here's what I would love for you to be and to do. These are the expectations of that. Do you agree? And to that, they say, all these words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. They sign a covenant in blood. They agree to this expectation with the reward of God's presence in a particular place for God's people. That was it. It's a reward. That's the denarius that they agreed to with the work of the heat of the day in their lives. So I would argue this helps shift exactly probably what Jesus is after and why he's teaching and who he's teaching this to. Because he's telling a Jewish audience in a Jewish setting a very Jewish parable. Hey, one of the major things this whole kingdom is about is the Gentiles, guys. And it seems like, and this is a struggle throughout all of his ministry, it seems like they just don't really want it to be. But that the God of the universe is moving to bless and put out the same benevolence, the same blessing, the same generosity that he showers on you, my Jewish people, to the ends of the earth. And that's the question. Jesus actually has the nerves to suggest the Gentiles might get the same blessing from God that the Israelites have experienced of God's presence, and ultimately a place for God's people. And he replied to one of them. And by the way, there's only a few other times where sort of the heat of the day is actually explicit in the text. And there's two of those stories. One of them is Abraham, where he's waiting after his circumcision by the heat of the day. And these total strangers show up, and he shows them tremendous hospitality. And the other one is like Jonah, who the main point of that of the story of Jonah is about God's mercy towards Israel's enemies. So you actually have two stories also connected to the idea of God's people actually being called to strangers and to Gentiles and to the outer world. But anyway, there's all so many cool interconnected parts. But verse 13, and he replied to one of them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong." So he's pointing out, this is what we agreed to. "Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I gave to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me, or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first will be last." He's like, look, I'm not being unfair to you. I'm actually just being generous to them. And this is the expressed lesson, I think, in this question. Why does my generosity bother you? The workers are frustrated over the very character of the landowner. Not because he cheated them, but because he was generous to others. And there's some question, too. If you're kind of a nerd like me, I'm like, yes, but Israel is the firstborn, the Bechor, the firstborn nation. They should get a double blessing, all this kind of stuff. Well, if you're asking that question, yeah, I might be the only one who is in the room. But if you are asking that question, I love that Jesus uses a vineyard, because Isaiah answers that question for us, which I think is really important. It's an image quite common in the Old Testament, but Isaiah uses it the most, particularly around Israel. And we get to a text that, it's a text that Jesus reads at the start of his ministry to say, this is the time that has come. So the Spirit of the God, Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to open up the prisons for those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance for our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant those who mourn in Zion, to give them beautiful headdresses, instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, and they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planted of the Lord, that he may be glorified. This is all a beautiful promise. And Jesus reads this. It's like, the day is fulfilled. Like, the kingdom is near. This is what's happening. They will build up the ancient ruins. They will raise up the former devastations. They will repair ruined cities, the devastation of many generations. Now, all that sounds good. And then we get this line. Strangers shall stand and tend your flocks. Foreigners will be your plowmen and vine dressers. Which is like, that doesn't sound good, but it keeps going. But you shall be called the priests of the Lord. They shall speak of you as the ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of nations, and in their glory you shall boast. Instead of your shame, there shall be a double portion. This is what promised Israel. Instead of dishonor, and you shall rejoice in their lot. Therefore, or thus, in their land they will possess a double portion. They will have everlasting joy. So this is the promise that God is going to begin this work to set the world right. And it's compared to a day when foreigners will tend the vineyards and flocks of the original audience of Israel. That's the image, that's the metaphor here. And I think Israel's invitation, and Jesus' invitation as well, is to become the people, that's the invitation on the table, to become the people, the type of people where our heart leaps and rejoices when you get told the double portion that you get, Israel, is that everything's back in the place. Everyone's being blessed. Everyone has enough. That will be your double portion. And some of you are like, great, but what do I do with all this, right? Cool. I'm glad there's some cool context stuff, Chris, in the story, but this is an audience that's first century Jews. What at all does this have to do with my life today? Which is great. Because I think the drive home point, the drive home centerpiece of the text is really around the character of the master. I think that's the focus. And Jesus is inviting his listeners to become the type of people that would rejoice at the character of the master, the generosity of the master, and not respond begrudgingly. And do we respond when encountering the actual scandal that is God's grace? Do we respond begrudgingly? hey, that's not fair. Or maybe just more mild, hey, that's really weird that it works that way, but he's the master, he gets to call the shots. Or we'd be the kind of people to rejoice, who see God's gracious acts towards anyone and to celebrate those things. And at first you're like, well, yeah, of course I'd celebrate grace, but let's dig in a little bit on that. Because when we see the graciousness, goodness, generosity of God, will we be molded into the kind of people that do truly rejoice in what makes God rejoice? Because God seems to really rejoice in these sort of things. God loves to be gracious. And the question is, how frustrating to possibly get to heaven and find out we don't really enjoy it. You get to heaven, and heaven's not really heaven, because heaven's more like hell, because you don't actually like what heaven is, because you don't really like unadulterated generosity. You don't want benevolence. Perhaps you worked hard. You did all the things that God demanded of you, and this other person didn't. And you start functioning like the elder brother in the prodigal son story. You kind of sit there going, but like, yeah, but he was the screw-up that ran away. Totally shamed his dad, did all of his things. I've been here working hard this whole time. And maybe you're like, but when I get to heaven, Chris, I'll just love it. Why? Why would you suddenly love graciousness when you struggle to love grace and fairness in this life? Because we have a God who loves sort of scandalous graciousness, God's unmerited favor and kindness towards someone like you and to me. The idea that God extends love, mercy, forgiveness to people who, though we don't deserve it and cannot earn any of it through our own efforts, he offers grace. He offers grace to murderers like Paul in the New Testament. And do you think some of the people that Paul murdered when he got to heaven were like, I'm so glad he's here? I don't know. I hope so. Or adulterers like David? You think Uriah and Bathsheba are leaping to watch David walk through the gates? I don't know. Liars, gossipers, stealers? What the cross makes is this giant mass invitation to all humanity, no matter the background, to come and experience the grace of the God of the universe. That's what the cross is. That's why we call it good news. If we're like, the good news is you're a sinner, it's like, well, that's a weird good news. But the good news is God's unmerited invitation for sinners to come to him. That's good news. And I know what some of you are thinking. Why would I have a problem with grace? But what if grace is extended to your own worst enemy? To your abuser? To your absent parent? The person who killed your family member? A molester? A slave owner? Would we still be the people to rejoice? What if we get to heaven and we find out that God's grace is actually truly universal? That maybe God actually is a universalist and everyone's there? Would we celebrate? Would we be so enthralled with the character of God, having purged the world of the wreckage caused by Satan, his lies, his evil, throws him into the lake of fire, and then ultimately brings everyone to him? Would we be okay with that? If Hitler's in heaven, or what do we think? Could we celebrate? If those questions all make you uncomfortable, okay. I think that's the challenge that Jesus has for us. The master's generosity feels unfair, not how we would do things. But he doesn't slight anyone in the story, but offers more than expected. Over the past few years, I've been really struck that Jesus' most provocative teachings, the things that stir the pot the most, are not any sort of hellfire and brimstone. It's not when he tells someone to go and sin no more. It's not when he goes around and says, repent and the kingdom is at hand. No one seems to actually bat an eye when Jesus kind of does some of those teachings. What really causes a problem, what really stirs the pot, is when he starts speaking of how gracious his Father is and just how inclusive his kingdom is. When Matthew, the tax collector, when the Syrophoenician woman, when this man experiencing paralysis, all become sort of pieces in his kingdom. makes me think, if I'm going to provoke when I teach, perhaps I'm in good company if I'm provoking around the themes of God's mercy and grace, and just how scandalous it is. But just how good it truly is that the God of the universe, while we were yet sinners, died for us. He so loved us that he sent his son to do the very work to begin bringing back a wayward creation back home. I love that it is the master who goes out to the field to the workers. And that's what he does with you and with me. He came to the Israelites out of sheer grace, calls them his own, agrees to be present and to be ultimately have a place, a kingdom that is theirs. And then he comes on that Christmas day into this world to be present with his creation and to ultimately have victory over sin and death, the very thing that we needed, which was to be unshackled from the old age. That through faith now, we enter into a relationship. We have the presence of God in us through the Holy Spirit, and we get a kingdom. Same denarius. And that's what's at hand. And Jesus challenges our understanding of fairness. Wants to break us of our categories. Does that mean God actually is a universalist? I'm not necessarily saying that either. But I think we should be challenged a little bit. Invites us to embrace the scandalous grace of God. And the master's generosity may seem unjust to us, but it reveals the depth of God's love and inclusivity in the kingdom. As we reflect on the story, I want us to consider, I want us to think about a few questions. As I invite Sarah up to come and actually lead us through the reflection, I just want to ask a few questions to kind of set up a little bit of her time. How do you react when confronted with the radical generosity of God's grace? Do you rejoice in it? Or do you find yourself questioning the fairness? The deathbed conversion, the ISIS member who actually came to faith. Are there areas in your life where you struggle to extend grace to others, especially those whom you might consider undeserving? Somebody who has hurt or abused you. What does it mean to embrace the inclusive nature of God's kingdom where all are welcomed and valued, regardless of their past or status? Think about heaven. Are you prepared to fully embrace the idea that God's grace extends to everyone, even those whom you find difficult to forgive or accept? And lastly, how do we embody the character of the master in this parable? How do we become like Jesus? Become like our God, choosing to celebrate and participate in God's gracious work into the world.